So we do have telephone go, and we are now going to call up tenants' rights union Santa Cruz activist Donna Dice for her update. So Donna, we hope you're listening, and we hope you're going to accept this call.
Hello, Donna Dice.
Hello, Robert Norris.
All right, now be sure you speak in a loud voice, Donna. We have, apparently it's kind of hard to hear the people at the other end.
Huh.
So feel free to shout, sing, and otherwise cavort at your end of the line. So Donna, you are a longtime worker with the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, in fact, one of the founders.
Yes.
And I guess we talked to you last a month ago, and you were telling us some pretty interesting horror stories about some guy up on, the hill where Highway 17 goes over the hill who was terrorizing.
Yeah, Norman Green.
Sorry?
Norman Green.
Tell us about him.
Well, he harassed and annoyed all of the neighbors. He was an ex-cop that was released from the force because of police brutality, and he thinks it's his right to do whatever he pleases, like in the good old days.
Sort of an old-fashioned guy.
Yes, he goes around killing people's dogs if they won't cooperate with them and leaving them on their front porch.
There's actually been a witness to that?
Yes, in fact, the county supervisor who does a pink eviction leads to homelessness knew this guy.
Which supervisor are we talking about?
He didn't realize he was a landlord. Dan Butte's his assistant.
And so this man, what's his name again?
Norman Green.
Mr. Green is a landlord, and have you actually contacted him to invite him to respond to these charges?
Not personally, no. Judy's done a fine job fighting her part of the battle.
So,
in fact, they had to get a team of lawyers on the other side, and they defaulted on the last papers that Judy submitted to the judge.
So what was the issue that Judy, I guess we're talking Judy's the tenant of Mr. Green?
Well, she has a halfway decent job. She's a machinist. She got injured, and they thought they could sue her for thousands of dollars because they didn't build the place where she was living up to code, and they didn't maintain it, and Judy had a video of the previous tenant who and how he left the place, and he refused to clean it up, and there's a lot of violations he has on that tape, which he tried to get the planning department to accept, but they didn't want to accept it. And with a little coercion, we finally got into the supervisor's office.
What kind of coercion?
What kind of coercion? Well, I was with her, and that always helps to have a witness. And we're both pretty strong, and once he knew who it was and the kinds of violations, and she had evidence in the form of all the red tag orders that nothing had been done about, that hadn't been enforced, and that made him a little nervous.
Him being?
The assistant. I forget his name.
Jan Butte's, Supervisor Butte's assistant?
Yes.
And you went to Supervisor Butte's in order to get what?
Some action on all these red tags, that he's renting out all these illegal units, and there's no septic tank, and he goes around clear-cutting and taking people's water, and, you know, he's got everybody scared because he goes around packing a gun.
And what was when you talked to Butte's aide, what kind of reassurances or brush-off did he give you?
Well, he said they were he did accept the videotape, and then he called her back and said they were going to go out there with a search warrant the next week, and then they dropped the ball, and then she won a judgment, and they didn't respond to her last papers, so...
What kind of a judgment
did
the tenant, Judy, win against the landlord?
I don't know all the specific details, but she successfully deflected their lawsuit.
Has the landlord ceased what you describe as his harassment of tenants, or does it continue?
Well, we don't know about that because she had to move out of the area.
Judy had to move out of the area?
Yeah.
So, in other words, the landlord may be up to his old tricks, huh?
Yeah, but he's quiet now. When they get quiet, that's a good sign. When they stop responding to your papers and being belligerent, it's always a good sign.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were working, I guess you got, you sought some kind of a grant from the city council, and you got, I guess you got Kennedy to try to back a grant that really didn't go anywhere. Isn't that the what happened to you about 6-9 months
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, they took over, the sheriff's department took over that space on Water Street. But we did get a grant from Vanguard, if there's any people that are into nonprofit work. You know, that's a very radical organization based in Northern California and San Francisco, and it's a good place to start, I think, rather than the city and the county, because obviously they're politically motivated.
Now, are you seeking,
landlords.
You're seeking members, what, at $1, $2, and $3 each to be a part of TRUSC, Tenants' Rights
right.
Union of Santa Cruz. And how are you doing on this membership drive?
Well, we really need somebody to come over and get lists of hundreds of names and start calling people up, and then we'll give them 30%.
Wow, so this is a paying position, huh?
Yeah.
Sort of a contingency fee.
Well, you know.
They get 30% of what they bring in.
Right, and
the rest
of it's all going towards healthy tenants.
So audience out there, if you're interested in helping and making money at the same time with the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, what number should be called, Donna?
426-0644. And we had another interesting, well, we always have interesting cases going on, but there's one case in particular we want to do a little bit of research into. It's a case where a welfare mom who's had some serious health problems and her son is asthmatic has lived in the house close to her son's school for 4 years and got into a little dispute with the landlord where he tried to evict her, and the process server actually came out and intimidated her, threatened her and refused to leave and got in her face and called her names and things like that, which was totally uncalled for because it wasn't an issue of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so the judge, Yance, just kind of let the demurrer go down.
Which means?
Well, a demurrer gives you more time, and if you win it, then they have to amend the complaint. Either way, he'll get the time unless you do a so-called...
It's a way for tenants to give themselves more time in fighting a landlord, right?
Yeah, and finding another place and trying to get out before there's more legal costs.
So Yance allowed the tenant, favored the tenant side or the landlord side?
The landlord side. And then she thought she found another place to move, and the landlord even was somebody that she knew personally, and it was going to work out. And then the landlord called the credit agency. It was either the credit agency or some kind of landlord networking organization, we're not sure which, actually told the prospective landlord that she was fighting an unlawful detainer, and I don't think that information should be allowed since there's no judgment in the case.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're trying to block tenants that fight for their rights from living here by networking, then we need to know exactly what's going on.
Well, maybe what the city council needs to do is make it a local crime, or maybe the Board of Supervisors, to discriminate against a tenant because of previous unlawful detainer actions, particularly ones that are in progress.
And especially when there's no money involved. You know, it might be a different case if the so-called, you know, horrible tenant actually exists that goes around from place to place, leaving the landlord stuck with bills, which I think is a pretty fictitious story.
Mm-hmm. You haven't seen that happening?
They're trying to promote such a story in Monterey County, so...
Really? How can you tell us about that?
Well, they published the name of a woman that evidently has had 13 unlawful detainers in Monterey County and tried to, you know, use that to smear tenants in general.
Have you talked to this woman, or do you know anything about that case?
It's an article we read about.
Well, I know that there was a movie in the I guess, the early 90s or late 80s about the... called The Tenant or something. It had starred the guy who played Batman, a short guy, and he also played in, I can never remember his name, Keaton, Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton, yeah.
Yeah, he played this tenant from hell who was was going after the poor yuppie couple who were renting out the flat. And it's kind of interesting. It reflects to me the temper of the times that makes heroes out of condo owners. I mean, it's just ridiculous in terms of the everyday conditions under which people are struggling. You're a person who actually spends many hours a week fighting for the rights of tenants. You go down to the courts, you look up the cases that where there are unlawful detainers being filed. You actually send out postcards to...
Right, and we get about 50% response rate. And so we, when people call, we take down their stories and look up the law for them and give them information that can help them feel more confident and stronger and give them a way to fight the abuse that's being perpetrated upon people. One apartment complex, they raised the rent 45%. Another complex, they raised, somebody bought the place, 5 units, and they raised the rent $300. These are the kinds of things we hope will motivate tenants to write their stories to Sacramento and help us pass more tenant legislation once tenants become more aware of the real issues involved.
Now, what is the situation? We've heard some mention, actually, I haven't played it on the air, but in conversations with Berkeley activists and previously, I'd heard that there is a statewide law which is going to sunset rent control. Do you have, I'm not quite clear about what this law is or does it exist. Can you give us some details?
They're going to try to pass that in November from what I heard statewide.
So, but right now, for example, cities like Santa Monica and Berkeley, which continue to have some form of rent control, are still, they have that that local option or not?
We'll have to see. This is going to be...
No, at the moment, I mean.
Yes.
So there's no law in place right now.
That, no.
Okay, but there's something coming up, you say, in November?
That's what I've heard, yes.
It's on the ballot, or it's...
I'm not sure if they have enough signatures to be on the ballot.
Well, we would probably know about it by now if they did. Because
I hope so.
Because I think that, you know, that would be... But I could be wrong about that, too. Yeah, if any callers know anything more about the situation for rent control cities in California, love to hear from you here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 at 427-3772. We're on the line with Donna Dice of the Tenants Rights Union of Santa Cruz. And Donna, I take it, invite callers to get in touch with you if they're either having problems with their landlord or want more information or want to help those who are?
Yes, 426-0644.
426-0644.
And there's a deadbolt law now that was passed in June, so if anybody's living in a place where they don't have deadbolts on the doors, they can inform the landlord that a new law has been in place for several months now.
Mm-hmm.
And regarding that.
So the law requires the landlord to get deadbolts?
Yes, on all the doors, exterior doors.
Now, you've been hearing probably quite a bit about the beach flats, what I call the Canfield Company giveaway, or the boardwalk boondoggle, the new beach area.
And seeing the little ad on Channel 3 all the time.
What is that ad?
Oh, Canfield looks so good. Promoting the boardwalk.
Well, what do you think? Is this, what do you think of this expansion plan? We've been trashing Canfield up and down here, but are we being unfair to him? What's your view? How does this affect tenants, and what does the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz say about this?
Well, we don't like to see a small percentage of people controlling everybody else's destiny in the form of profit-making from housing and making it difficult to provide more housing from the people that are already here and have been here for a long time and deserve to have a place to live in which they're free from harassment, invasion of privacy, substandard conditions, and being allowed to actually have the quiet enjoyment of the place that they're renting, not have to worry that they might be evicted for some trivial reason.
Well, what about the proponents of this plan claim that the beach area, the beach flats, is a slum filled with substandard housing, and that it needs to have some kind of upgrading, whereas the opponents say, well, Canfield has allowed some of his properties to deteriorate into that condition, and others have, you know, there have been lack of improvements made in some cases because of the whole Canfield fix here, where the area is not being, you know, is being told you're going to have your houses bulldozed anyway, so why renovate them or bring them up to, you know, improve them. And there are also those who say, I believe Jane Baer is among them, she's a local activist in the beach flats and a resident, that everything's up to code, that at least all their properties are up to code. If there hadn't been, if things weren't up to code, there would have been red tagged right and left and all kinds of, there have been... What do you think? Have you gotten complaints or concerns about this?
Yes, I've heard both sides of that argument. Linda Gardner, who's works at the city council and who's the person that's supposed to be contacted if they have a substandard place in the flat says that both places are minimally standard, but that's not what I get from the calls that I get of people living with cockroaches and broken doors and windows and the landlord's nowhere around. So,
Now, that's the claim of Scott Kennedy and Eric Larson, that the beach flats is sort of populated, you know, by people suffering from absentee landlords who don't give a damn what happens there. And indeed, they've claimed, well, not Eric Larson, but I believe Kennedy and Hernandez, there was a brouhaha around whether Phil Baer and other landlords were trying to engage in discrimination against tenants through racist meetings and so forth, which that's been pretty thoroughly discredited and showed to be a, seemed to be by tactic by Kennedy and Hernandez. However, what about it? Are there, you know, are there, is there truth to the claims that the beach flats is, you know, a big slum and that it, the city has allowed that to happen? And that
I don't think you can completely make that kind of blanket statement. No, there are places that are being redeveloped through the redevelopment agency and, you know, it's a case-by-case thing. You'd have to look through the records, all the homeowners of every place in the beach flats to really analyze the situation fairly.
Actually, we're going to be playing a tour by Jane Baer later in the show, which the audio portion, you can't, of course, see it. And we actually had Becky Johnson was doing a video of the entire, or much of the walk we went on several weeks ago, almost a month ago now, with activist Jane Baer, talking about the different homes that are being dismissed as slums and, you know,
well, it is shocking. I think any tourist, you know, going down to the end of Front Street towards the boardwalk there can see that several houses have been totally neglected and they wonder why they're allowed to, the landlords aren't being pressured to maintain their property.
Well, is this a good argument for the Canfield Company's claim that there should be a complete redevelopment and the beach boardwalk area should be, well, that they should accept the beach south of Laurel plan?
No, because we need more housing than we have now. And if they take that out for the convention center, not only are they depriving more people of housing where they live and where they work, they're also catering to the tourists, which is not fair to the people that live here. We already know the problem people have walking down the beach with their dogs. That's a whole other issue. I guess the dog owners are starting to organize on that now, too.
No, I haven't heard about that one. You want to...
Yeah.
You're a dog lover as well as being a tenant lover?
Well, a lot of people can't rent a place if they have a dog. So it seems like there's a lot of homeowners that have dogs, and they should organize because these are our beaches. You know, we have a right to go down there and not be harassed and threatened with the ticket just because you want to let your dog play a little bit. You know, there should be places for people to do that.
Perhaps people should bring their dogs to city council to do a little barking. What else is going on around Trusk? I know you got to leave shortly. Anything that people should know about in terms of state actions coming up? I know that you're, one of your main organizers has gone to New York and is whooping it up in the delis, so not around.
I doubt it.
And, well, perhaps not. What, anything happening locally that we should be alert to or aware of, or anything happening in the near future that we should know about?
Can you hold on a second?
Sure. We're on the line talking to Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, Trusk activist Donna Dice, who has been working for tenants for the last 2 years and fought her own unlawful detainer retaliatory eviction, won several retaliatory eviction suits against landlords who wanted to stop her organizing and her helping tenants. Donna, you back yet?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
We have spaghetti feeds Friday night. If you want to come, give us a call, 5:30 to 8:30. If you have any tenant problems, call us up.
Phone number?
426-0644.
Mm-hmm.
Need help with any legal paperwork, call us up.
426-0644.
And if you want to write to Sacramento Tenant Legislature, I have the address for that also.
Hey, well,
it's
listen.
It's happening.
Well, listen, Donna, I appreciate your joining us, and sorry about the phone difficulties we were having. Again, if you want to get a hold of Donna Dice or the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, 426-0644. And if you forget that number, just give me a call on the Huff line at 423-HUFF.
Yeah, and we're actually getting a lot of calls now from tenants about other issues besides eviction, so I know our number is getting out there, which I'm glad.
That's great. Anything you want to say about those issues, or shall we talk to you about that?
Well, it's just, you know, nobody has to feel alone or, you know, embarrassed about the situation they have gotten into, because, you know, we're all connected, we're all in the same thing, and we're here to help, not judge anybody's situation.
Thank you, Donna Dice.
Okay.
All right. I hope to talk to you again.
Okay.
To their knees, complain about the tries to hold her up. Even she no longer knows. The lamp goes out, the evening now is closed. And nobody finds flowers from the flower lady.
Phil Oakes, Flower Lady, from the 60s. Beautiful song. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. We're in the 90s, and we're at 427-3772 if you want to reach us. Last time you heard a very wrenching interview with an older vet who talked about abuse by police officer Brent Northrup. He had his van banged on while he was having a catheter empty his bladder one night while he was trying to get some privacy in his van up on the west side. And he described in detail how that happened, how he was eventually given a $162 sleeping ticket, sleeping in a vehicle even though there was no evidence he was sleeping, simply on the whim of Officer Northrup. Now, I filed a letter of complaint about that, and I read you that letter in the last show. We talked further with Lloyd Lawrence, and he gave us one of his poems, which you're now going to hear.
This is Ode to a Purple Heart. I met a vet who had no hand to shake the one I'd given. He left them both on Iwo Sand, but still he made a living. I heard a well-dressed woman say it should be made a crime to sell his pencils day by day to pencils for a dime. Perchance one day I passed her way as someone snatched her purse. Stop that thief, I heard her say in words so loud and terse. The vet who did not have a hand by instinct and bad luck brought down the thief into the sand where in his gut a knife was stuck. He died on American sand where one commits no crime to freely sell throughout the land two pencils for a dime.
Unfortunately, Lloyd is wrong about that in Santa Cruz. There is a crime, particularly if certain officers are watching, at least in their eyes. And to offend a police officer, for most of us, can be as terrifying as going to court about it. The crime in Santa Cruz, which is non-existent, is panhandling downtown under the downtown ordinances, which is to say seeking anything of value from a passerby, even if you're only offering pencils in exchange. And it was the case last year that certain officers were coming up to people who had disabled signs, demanding that they verify they were disabled in order to engage in First Amendment activities like, can I have a dime, please? Now, I don't know if this is continuing. I'm hopeful it is not. But I haven't heard the city council speak out on the issue. I haven't heard it made clear from the hosts or the police that it is perfectly legal. You don't have to justify or prove what you're saying about a sign. In fact, anybody who has a sign can panhandle day or night downtown, provided they remain mum. That is the gag order of the Santa Cruz City Council, the Kennedy Rotkin Matthews law that was passed in 1994, making it illegal to ask for anything after dark, $162 fine for the first peaceful request, for the second one, up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine. So I guess we might say that Lloyd is partially right, that it's not a crime in Santa Cruz if you do it at the right time, in the right place, and you happen to not be seen by the wrong police officers. No word yet from Chief Belcher, Mayor Celia Scott, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the San Jose Mercury News, the American Civil Liberties Union, or the Citizens Police Review Board, all of whom received copies of this letter that I wrote to them about the disgraceful harassment of Lloyd Lawrence. Now, there's another person I've been following, and this is kind of more of a historical tape than one that has immediate moment, although it is recent enough for us to be concerned. The case of Chris Brozda, the man arrested for unsightly appearance at Marini's Candies and then taken to jail by an officer for challenging to fight, where he had actually simply stated he wanted to have a fair contest with a police officer. Now, I talked to Lieutenant Velasquez, who Chris Brozda, this is the man we're talking about, said Chris Brozda testified under oath in the court of Judge Salazar, and I heard him, and I have it on tape, unfortunately not for broadcast yet, because you need to get a special motion from the court to allow that to happen. Brozda claimed that he went to Lieutenant Velasquez and issued a simple challenge to police officers, suggesting they sublimate their hostilities by getting into an arena with him in a fair fight of some sort. Now, Velasquez denied that that's what Brozda had said. He was Velasquez is kind of the smooth PR end of the police department, similar to Lieutenant Locke. Velasquez told me, Brozda was upset, but he wasn't upset enough for me to put him in jail, that he was simply arguing in a hostile manner, but it wasn't really. He kept kind of, showing his great compassion, but he denied that Brozda had said that it was a calm proposal for him to get into the arena with other officers. Why is this significant? Because if an individual makes that kind of an offer to the police, it may be ill-advised, but it certainly isn't criminal. And if police then use that offer to hold him in jail, as Brozda was held in jail for 72 days, theoretically you can only be held for 30 days in custody before they have to take you to trial, but the Judge Salazar, in his infinite wisdom, found it appropriate to involve psychiatric authorities to come down and attempt to conserve Brozda based on the fact that he was living in his van, and so was homeless, and so was, quote, gravely disabled. This, of course, mixed with his prickly tendencies, his refusal to waive time, which is to say abandon his right to a speedy trial, his difficulties with the public defenders, who he quite properly was concerned were not defending him in the manner to which he was entitled. Though I must say, the public defender that I saw working with him at the hearing where he was finally released, eventually because all the charges were dropped, and he actually lost that hearing in another sense, that public defender was not so bad. She attempted to have him able to defend himself to the extent of taking one hand out of the shackle. They had shackles on his feet and shackles on his hands, and Brozda has a medical condition where he has a huge hernia kind of extending from his belly. It's a very difficult condition for him to be in when he's also trying to write and have a shackle on his hand at the same time. Our great liberal Commissioner Salazar is actually from the DA's office, and though the most liberal of all the judges, ironically, was not liberal enough to let him free one hand. Brozda had previously refused to come to court shackled in both with hands and feet, claiming it would interfere with his defense, so this was the second time they had brought him to court, and he finally agreed to do it just because he wanted to get it over with. Salazar found him guilty of a probation violation, which again, I guess I've discussed in previous shows. Probation is a very deadly condition to accept if you're an activist or if you're a vulnerable homeless person who's likely to be harassed by the police again, because the very act of police contact can be considered a form of a probation violation. That's considered police contact. If the police contact you, if there's cause to call the police, that can be the basis for throwing you back into a condition of jail for the rest of the sentence, even though you thought you had gotten out of that with the probation. And in this particular probation hearing, as I think I discussed on the air at one point, Brozda had claimed that we had to do with going into a pizza parlor, the pizza parlor downtown across from the bookshop Santa Cruz, where apparently a manager, by his account, had it in for him, and he was careful not to go directly inside, but the manager called the police anyway, and the police officers eagerly called him away. The officer involved, he'd had a problem with an officer, Richards, who he claimed had threatened his life at a prior incident at the Saturn Cafe. Anyway, it's a long series of, it's allegations, but to me it's more than allegations based on the fact that the the court system is holding someone for such a long period of time, holding him in solitary in some cases, trying to forcibly dope him up, trying to forcibly take away his rights. Here we're going to talk to Chris's father, Joe Brozda, who appeared on his behalf, and he talks about his case in the corridors of the Santa Cruz courthouse. Okay, it's August 31st, and about 20 to 11 here in the corridors outside Department 2. I'm here outside John Salazar's court with Joe Brozda, chess player and a devoted dad. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Joe, you are a regular court habitué these days, not as a defendant, however, but as a man who's trying to keep an eye on proceedings to help out, or at least make sure that he's not further injured, Chris Brozda, your son, who was here on Friday, or at least he tried to be here, but he apparently didn't allow him in court. What was that all about?
They wouldn't let him in court because he refused to accept the chains on his legs and arms and across his belly and on his wrists and so forth.
So how many chains did he actually have? Did you see him or did you hear about this?
Well, he was supposed to have a belly chain across to each wrist and his ankles too. And the bailiff said that it was their job to do that and they couldn't bring him over without doing that because of the fact that he had been argumentative in the past.
So they were afraid of his rapier wit?
No, I guess they were afraid of his 260 pounds and his fearsome beard.
Aha. Well, a beard can be a fearsome thing. Of course, he was there, as I understand it, he was arrested over 2 months ago around Marini's candy store, actually in the copy roasting company next door, for 415, challenging the fight, involving an incident where, in frustration with another police bit of harassment as he perceived it, he offered the officer an opportunity for a fair fight in an arena of his choice, and the officer used that as an excuse to jail him, and of course the two-month period is far beyond the period they can hold you in custody without a trial. You're guaranteed a trial after 30 days on a misdemeanor criminal charge, and so these charges are no longer valid, but instead they tried a psychiatric entrapment situation where they sent him off to Dominican and then to Harbor Hills, but he beat that with a habeas corpus hearing, and now he's back and they offered him a deal for a year. I think he agreed to be away from the mall for a year as a probation condition. He refused that, and here he is again. Apparently the time is extended beyond all charges except for the one which is breaking probation. Am I accurately reflecting that?
Yeah, the only charge is they're going to drop everything except the probation violation.
Ironically, the probation violation is something that, by the probation violation, they're talking about the so-called disturbing the peace or car, threatening to fight charges, which apparently haven't stood up enough to be taken to trial. At least that's one interpretation of why they haven't been taken to trial. I guess there are others. And so the charge doesn't have enough merit to get proof beyond a reasonable doubt, yet they're going to try to use this to keep him in jail for a longer period of time?
My understanding is that probation violation carries 6 months. He's already served almost three. If he were to serve the next three, I guess that would be the time for the probation violation. But I agree with you. How can they hold him when the basis of the probation violation are being thrown out today?
Because they want to, or as Sergeant Clark said, because they can, as he took away homeless property 2 years ago from the City Hall Sleepers Vigil, and kind of a memorable statement that he made. How can you do that, Sergeant Clark? How can you steal their sleeping gear? Because I can, said Sergeant Clark. So perhaps the courts are in essence telling us the same thing. I spoke with former attorney Ray Glad-Grunick, who, and other legal people. He's no longer giving legal advice. But my understanding now from talking to numerous folks is that the probation situation depends on whether he was already sentenced or whether he was given probation pending sentence. If he was given probation pending sentence, they can give him as long a sentence as they want and then stick him in jail for that. Or they can, however, if he was already sentenced, they can only give him the maximum sentence time if he is convicted at this hearing, where apparently he will have access to counsel but not to a jury trial, and the standard of evidence is lower. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. I think it's clear and convincing, perhaps preponderance of the evidence to show that there is a violation. And really, probation is not one of my major areas of study, but my understanding is that even a contact with a police officer can be considered a probation violation under some circumstances, which in Chris's case puts him in a highly vulnerable position because police officers like to contact Chris for some reason.
Yeah, the police officers, in fact, I was sitting right here when I overheard a conversation on Friday between the police officer that came to testify and the junior district attorney. They said that Chris was very intelligent, but that he was always getting into trouble, and that the officer said he frequently goes over to his van to wake him up. And so Chris is being spooked by the fact that that the police have been waking him up. So he's at the point where when he sees a police officer now, he's kind of spooked. And so I don't know if he'll ever every time he talks to a police officer, there's a chance of a probation violation.
You're being very mellow when you say that they wake him up. What you mean to say is that
they give him a ticket.
They give him a $62 sleeping bag.
He gets a ticket for sleeping in his vehicle. Now, if he's not sleeping in his vehicle, they report the fact that he must be sleeping under a tree, which is also against the law, apparently, in this town.
Indeed. Sleeping, as we know, is considered criminal behavior for those who lack the funds for adequate lodging, as it should be in an upscale community of our sort.
Upscale community. you know, I've tried for a long time to get him housing. As a matter of fact, he has two vans. I told somebody he was homeless, and they said, where does he sleep? I said, he sleeps in one of his two vans that I bought for him. And the guy said, homeless? He's not homeless.
And yet...
The court is opening up. And yet the court has said...
He's illegally sleeping in those vans. That's the problem.
Indeed, he was held on a psychiatric hold as gravely disabled on the basis that sleeping in a van indicates a grave disability?
No.
We'll talk about that later.
And actually, I think that certainly was a part of the reason, though Joe said, no, we're going to... I'll re-examine that tapes and give you more information on that, but that was a real concern we had, that Chris was not being held against his will in a psychiatric facility because he was considered a danger to himself or others, but because he was gravely disabled, which anyone who knows Chris can testify is not the case. He may not like Chris at some times in his metamorphosis. He may like him a lot, but he's not gravely disabled. He's being severely disabled by police harassment, as many other homeless people are who try to sleep in their vehicles or somewhere in the city of Santa Cruz without harassment. Michael Rotkin, our swing vote on the city council's claims to the contrary, notwithstanding. Which kind of brings us to our next segment. The city council candidates, I mentioned, we've reached an interesting and important watershed, a historic watershed, really, in the city council race, where more than a majority of the council candidates now favor ending the sleeping ban. And here we can hear the answers of the candidates at their most recent public forum, which was on community TV last Thursday. The candidates present were Chris Crone, Keith Sugar, Tim Fitzmaurice, Jane Walton, and Ron Quartararo. Not present were Linda Steinau and Rodent and Pat Clark. Clark had already declared he was in favor of ending the sleeping ban. Rodent hadn't made any statement whatsoever on the subject. He hasn't been to any forum, and as I say, announced after that show that he was withdrawing. And Linda Steinau has announced she favors keeping the sleeping ban. But these were the statements that you're about to hear from the candidates who were at the community TV forum on Thursday on the issue of the sleeping ban.
Going on here in those voices from the
Thank you very much. I'm really glad to hear from this morning to acknowledge the policy that the judge eventually goes forward to that account. My question is, do you support amending the county amendment to the amendment to Section 2 and including the covering up of the blanket between the 11th and 16th Amendment, which is on sale on public area and on private property, not with the county amendment, but measuring it to repeal the sleeping ban?
Across the floor.
I feel like the current camping ordinance does make it a crime to sleep, and I do support amending that ordinance. I think that we can do a lot more. If the caller is referring to homeless programs as well, Joe, I think the current city council is doing a lot. with regards to homelessness, but a lot more also can be done. And recently I did visit with Karen Gillette from the Homeless Resource Center, and many good programs are going on. We need to stabilize homeless, funding for homeless programs currently, and we need to focus on job development and job creation for folks who are currently homeless. Thank you.
Tim, the most of the question is, do you deliver...
Another question. It's a tough question. It's an important question, because it shouldn't be criminal behavior to provide it on the middle of the night into the bus. It shouldn't be. And I think some amendment, the people need to understand the camping ban keeps people from camping in a variety of locations in the city, but the sleeping ban essentially cause the arrest of a woman and her child sleeping in a van in the street, and that we really need to understand what the implications are of city ordinances like this. And so, I think the notion that it needs to be amended in some way in order to make sure that it serves its real purpose makes absolute sense. And once again, and just to tackle what Christopher said, people should understand that.